now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking goals as Liverpool hit four without Mo Salah and Arsenal score five after two goalless games at the Emirates. We'll also be talking about Ivan Toney's return and, as it's been a few weeks, we'll have to chat VAR again after controversial decisions in Sheffield United's draw with West Ham. And joining me, Tom Clark, to discuss all of that, we have a football writer brimming with glee as her team are 5 points clear at the top of the Premier League. It's Alison Rudd. And a former defender who, when it comes to goals, managed a season high of two in Chesterfield's 2008-09 season. It's Gregor Robertson.
That scored two goals in one season.
Apparently so, yeah.
That's news to me.
According to the stats you did, anyway. We had hoped that Tom Allnutt would be with us as well, but sadly he has been delayed by the trains and the weather drama, and he's got to get to Cobham to talk to Mauricio Pochettino later. So you'll have to make do with me. I might have to throw some opinions in for once, rather than just asking some questions.
Or you could just pick on Gregor a bit more because he opened himself up to that in his piece today about Ivan Toney.
He did.
And how... Well, you've written it, Gregor.
What? Go on, continue.
Sheer terror in Gregor's face as Alison started to make it.
You're passing back to your goalkeeper.
My short back pass, yeah.
Yeah, and you say... Yeah. What is it you say to yourself? Not short.
Not short.
Not short. And what do you do?
I played it short.
Nice. That's. I think that's really interesting. It's very brave of you to admit it, but... B, it does prove that the whole idea of negative reinforcement, which is why that teachers and parents shouldn't tell children off. And, don't forget your coat.
Yeah,
forget your homework.
No, actually, yeah.
You're telling yourself off in advance, aren't you? So what you've put in your head is, I'm going to play this short, because the word short is lodged in your brain.
Yeah. We should say that this piece was about Ivan Toney being... the opposite of this, in that his conviction about how good that he belongs in any stage, that everything that had been swirling around recently, so much scrutiny, he was able to block it all out and deliver the business on his return, and that he'd visualised doing exactly that, which I found fascinating, partly because it's so alien to me. Mm-hmm. And I also point out that there are other players, Jamie Carragher for one, Eddie Howe, who've said that their biggest motivation is fear. So Ivan Toney, to me, has been pretty fascinating in the last couple of weeks because he has had no fear whatsoever, despite everything that's happened to him recently.
Well, you've teased some little nuggets from Gregor's piece, Alison, and I'm going to leave the listeners begging for more by bringing it up towards the end of the show, I think. But it is a fascinating piece, so make sure you stick with us. But we're going to start with Bournemouth and their defeat against Liverpool and Henry Winter's match report starting like this. Everyone knows that Manchester City will respond to Liverpool's title challenge because of the champion's quality and character, but what a relentless, fearless challenge it is turning out to be from Jurgen Klopp's side. Liverpool are 5 points clear, their number nine is firing, their captain is commanding again, and they have youngsters stepping in and stepping up. City know that they have a fight on their hands. Now, Gregor, Bournemouth was potentially seen as a bit of a tough challenge before this game, and in some ways it wasn't really a 4-0 match, was it, in terms of particularly how Bournemouth started the game and some of the chances that they managed to create, but it did have a feel to me of this is what the best teams do, isn't it? It was almost quite a City-like performance in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, there was a really interesting little chart at the bottom of Hamza's piece as well in the paper today that kind of showed the momentum flow, and which, clever data-minded people can do these days. and there was, but Bournemouth had a lot of the play, and that's what they do. They do not sit back. They throw everything at any team, and so there were periods in this game that Bournemouth were very much in it, but what Liverpool were like clinical, And it's just another kind of, just underlined how many sort of attacking options they have. Jota's come back and he's absolutely hit the ground running. Gakpo coming on. Elliot stepping up. You know, the players who, some of the young players as well who are coming in and really making an impact. Is he referring to Darwin Núñez being the number nine who's firing? I mean, he scored one goal in 16 games before that. I think people...
Yeah, but he's firing now, isn't he? Come
right,
on.
Okay. So he
don't let that get in the way of a good intro.
He fired in a game.
We all okay. know that.
Well, look, they could do with him firing, particularly now Salah's injured and they don't know how long he's going to be away at AFCON. But I remain to be convinced that he's going to do it consistently.
Do you not think he looks a bit sharper?
Than when? He looked sharp at the start of the season. He's always looked sharp.
So we know from our good pal Tony Cascarino that goals, once they start coming, they keep coming. And so he scored, I know he's only scored one in whatever it was, 16 before, but two in this game. That's a good start. And you would know, talking about confidence, as we were before, about your career and Ivan Tony's and things, that confidence and being told, moved into the centre as well by Klopp, making changes, that as well is confidence building, given the central spot. Then scoring,
yeah, it's
going
all
to take that forward.
It's all positive, but as I say, the start of the season, I remember we discussed Paul Joyce writing a piece about how he'd kind of turned a corner in his Liverpool career, and he's turning all the positive play and all the kind of support. There's still so much support for Núñez at Anfield. They see everything else he does, but he was kind of finally turning that into goals, and then.
So do you think? So just. To be clear, you don't think he's got the potential, but he's not yet there, or you actually think you've seen that he will get there.
I remain to be convinced that he will get there, that he will be consistent and score, 30 goals in a season in the same way as some of the best players do.
Alison,
I would agree. I don't see enough evidence of that, but I do see a lot of evidence of how he fits into the team and fits the character of the team. I agree, the scoreline is a bit not quite reflective of the passages of play, but throughout, even during the first half, Liverpool have what they have, which makes you quite calm from a Liverpool fan perspective in a game like this, is they have a compelling personality, which is, and Núñez is part of that. So they fight for every ball. They have relentless energy. I didn't think it was a City-like, Man City-like performance at all, Tom, actually, because I think City are quite grown up and contained, whereas Liverpool are the life and soul of the party type of team.
Still think they're a bit mad? I think they're getting a bit more grown up.
No, I don't think they are at all.
A bit crazy.
No, because when they are calm, the goals aren't coming. You have to wait for them to feel under pressure or to go behind.
They often have very, very below par halves of football, too.
Yeah, exactly. But they seem to need, I don't know, an incentive to just show the quality and become relentless. So it's almost, I imagine, overwhelming for the opposition, no matter how well set up they are or what great run they're on or how much they believe in their own system. Then they're not really like any other team in that they are a team that have a lot of quality and might well win the title, and yet they play like every game's a bit of a cup final.
How is that? Have you made peace with that now as a fan? Because you were talking at the start of the season about it making you a bit jittery and falling behind.
Because it happens all the time. I'm now.
Are you okay with it?
Yes, I am now.
It's fine.
I'm fine. We'll score four by the end of the game. I'm used to it. It's like you can get used to someone who bullies you. I'm used to it. I'm absorbing it. It's fine.
Darwin fits
into that, you see. And that's why he's sort of immune to the normal criticism that a number nine would get. Because I agree with you, Gregor. I don't think he's going to be a 30-goal-a-season striker. But he brings... He somehow embodies this version of Klopp's Liverpool.
The wildness, yeah. There's an interesting little nugget in Hamza's piece that was Liverpool's goal difference in all competitions this season is plus 49, plus 8 in the first half and plus 41 in the second.
Yeah.
That's pretty extraordinary, I think. It shows that... It's not We keep using the word control. There's a period where Arsenal looked like they were very controlled. Man City, it's often a word you use about them. There's still not much control. And I know that sounds daft after they've won 4-0, but yeah. It's true. It's not like
But you know,
measured, controlled performances.
You know how Klopp is famous for standing out on the pitch when both teams are warming up and watching what the opposition do to warm up, and people think that's quite quirky and how come he's still doing it? I think he actually does do a lot of stuff on the hoof. And so at half time, he's worked out what the opposition are doing, what their weaknesses are, which areas of the pitch they're not controlling properly, where they need more energy and how he needs to. Because he did shift around his front three. It's not rocket science. There are only three positions and you can move people around. But he does it because he's reacting to what he's seen. That's not a one-off. He's done it in almost every single match. At half-time, it's either the pep talk or it's an actual shifting of position. And it has almost always worked that whatever he does at half-time, they come out Liverpool and they have more of everything. And that is partly because of how Klopp is prepared to be thinking about things as they're unfolding and not in that sense of I've got a plan and we're sticking to the plan. He's quite happy to rip things up at half time. I think that's exciting.
I was just going to add, as Henry wrote in his piece, Klopp substitutes have been involved in 31 goals, 15 goals, 16 assists this season. So that's pretty impactful.
Well, speaking of statistics, Gregor, producer Neil, as the fourth man of the show, from silently from afar, from behind the glass, has just messaged me with a statistic. Nunes, the only player to have 10 goals and 10 assists this season. Combined, 10 and 10, first player to both. Mo Salah leads the combined list, 14 goals and 8 assists, but Nunes has got 10 and 10. Prepared to change your mind?
Yeah, look, as I say, a lot of that was, you know, he started the season very well. Very, very well. And it's been a little bit more of a barren spell recently, but he's still contributing to the team. I'm not disputing that at all.
Yeah. Coming back to Jurgen Klopp, Alisson, and you were talking about personality and some of the things that he's doing, he seems to be happy and creative again. And I remembered when I was prepping for the show, thinking about something, Gregor, you said about Pep Guardiola a few weeks ago and saying how he talks about being happy with his team. How much do you think it seems an obvious thing to say, but these managers being happy when they've been there a long time, and they have so much work to do and so much pressure, that idea that he's quite excited by this group of players that he's got, he likes the slightly mad way that they approach games and that they go behind and then they win late on. Do you think that's a big factor in this Liverpool this season? Just trying to think of games like the Arsenal FA Cup game, when they had a probably slightly inferior team under pressure, still come through. Do you think a happy, slightly fun, jovial Klopp is key to Liverpool's success?
No, it's absolutely key, isn't it? Because it's the glass half full, half empty type of approach, isn't it? You could look at Liverpool and decide, oh, woe is me. You know, Trent Alexander-Arnold, one of the most exciting players. Oh, he's injured. You know, Mo Salah at the Africa Cup of Nations. Oh, this is just all coming at the wrong time. Or you can be as Klopp is and see it as an opportunity for a wealth of talent that is coming through to get properly involved, and the way he's integrated young players has been, you know, textbook perfect. So you give someone like Conor Bradley time in non-Premier League games, in the cup games, allow him to understand that he's got what it takes and he's not going to freeze, he can integrate properly. So then you say, go on, have your Premier League debut. And he played incredibly well, and for someone with so little experience. And Klopp genuinely seems to enjoy taking players from the academy and pushing them through, rather than seeing it as, oh, well, am I having to do that? I haven't got quite as much resources as someone like City. It's not fair. He does seem to relish that, and that will have a impact going through. It means that the players who are there, who might have been worried that City were going to catch them up because they were a bit weakened, will think, well, if Klopp thinks that these new players are fantastic, then they are fantastic. And they help the new players and they form partnerships quicker than they might otherwise have done. So the classic example is Harvey Elliott and Mo Salah. You wouldn't have said, I don't know how many years ago, oh, I bet those two get on really well, and on the pitch you see wonderful little patterns and interchanges between them. But when they play on the pitch together, you know, Mo Salah is, you know, he's a a sort of, I don't know, he has his targets he wants to reach. He wants to have assists and goals, and he's quite selfish in that sense. But he really wants Harvey Elliott to shine, and he loves the way that Harvey Elliott can dovetail with him. And so you see that the established stars always at Liverpool very keen to form relationships with up-and-coming players, and that's the only way, because there are so many good academies in the Premier League and none of them quite do it. But Liverpool have a tradition. It started with Steve Highway at Liverpool, who had was, you know, really forward-thinking with how he brought players through, making sure you squeeze from the local pool of talent and make sure you're the club that gets them. And so many academies aren't really run that way, where they actually have a proper link with the first team. They're more like money-making operations. But at Liverpool, they have this thing where the kids there really believe they will get a chance. And every time one does, that must a thousandfold make every single kid at the academy think it can happen. And then it feeds on itself and it feeds on itself. So now, when you have something like, oh no, Mo Salah's going to have to go away for international duty, it doesn't really fill you with panic, because you know there are players coming through who can help the system, and they're all working to the same system, and the players at the academy will know what the sort of thing that Klopp wants, because he's been there long enough for it to feel like a Klopp organisation. So and that it comes back to your original question, Tom, which is that all comes from the force of personality of the manager and the energy he exudes, so that if there are problems, he's delighted to have to solve them. He wants to do that. He loves it.
Gregor, Bournemouth, is this the classic cliched reality check for them after a good run over the Christmas period?
Yeah, but there's still a lot to
Will this just happen to this team at times?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the reality of the level they are at, you know. But I still think there's a lot to be positive about. You know, the game against Spurs they lost, they were pretty valiant in as well. I think Iraola kind of said as much afterwards. He said that, like, Liverpool, they were right in the game, and Liverpool kind of stepped up another level after the break, and some, really there's not much you can do about that. But Bournemouth are, you know, I think Bournemouth's improvement has been pretty remarkable, actually, and as they did in this game, they're still a really tough proposition for any team to face in the Premier League.
Alison?
Tom?
Feeling more confident or less confident as the season progresses about your title chances?
I thought you were going to say more confident about Bournemouth. I'm sure Bournemouth will survive.
Just want to finish on the title, because that was the start with Henry Winter's piece, kind of going down the route that a lot of us are thinking this Premier League season is heading down, coming more towards a two-team race for the title rather than this big, exciting 4-5-team scramble that people like me were envisaging in November. Are you feeling more confident or less?
I think if Liverpool can beat City at Anfield, they've won the title.
What a claim. What a claim. Gregor, agree?
We've got Arsenal and Chelsea before that.
Yeah.
Just at the turn of the month.
Chelsea's no problem. Come on.
But I think, you know, I think they would be in a pretty strong position then, absolutely. I think I've said it before, I think Liverpool arguably have the deepest and most sort of variable squad as well, you know. They have the most kind of number of options, but whether they are the best team in the league or not is the debatable thing still. Mm. And personally, I think City might still come out on top.
Yeah, we know. You think City might win. Shocking. Good opinion. Anyway, let's move on to some other opinions, because I'm sure we might fall out about them.
What do you think, Tom?
What
so
do
you've
I
promised
think?
Opinion. I've not actually heard one yet.
I think Villa are going to win the title.
Oh, great. Okay. Stick to asking the questions.
To Sheffield United then, and let's start with some other decisions and see if we can fall out about them, because before we get onto any of the football or the goals or whatever it means, VAR is back. I mean, this was an absolutely bonkers game, wasn't it? And kind of slightly befitting of what we might have expected from Chris Wilder when he returned to Sheffield United, because it was blood and thunder and Bramall Lane well behind them and things like that. Didn't quite get the win that perhaps they needed. Let's go through the decisions. Rhian Brewster's red card. Anyone think it wasn't a red card? I don't think it was a red card, Alison. There you go. There's an opinion. How you like me now? I think it was a little harsh.
I think it was one of many orange cards. Unfortunately, we do not have orange cards.
Yes.
So you have to let the referee on the pitch decide whether he feels it was dangerous or not.
And I think then in the orange card category, once you've given the yellow, I think you stick with the yellow. I don't think you then upgrade. If you then look at it and go, so I'm on the fence about this one, surely you stick with your original decision.
That was supposed to be the spirit of VAR, but they've introduced this go and look at the screen and someone in your ear saying, ooh, that's bad.
Yeah, and then slowing it down and then freeze framing it and going, oh, the studs are high. Gregor?
Yeah, look, I don't think Ryan Brewster can have too much to complain about, to be honest. Like, I agree fundamentally, but the way that the game is now, it was at full speed. You know, he didn't even kind of, it wasn't even one of them where the player's going to, I think it was Emerson, was going to play a pass and he kind of caught his stud. He went right through his legs and almost his sort of standing legs as well. So I think there was always a possibility he was going to get sent off.
Can I ask you a question about red cards that just popped into my head, which just shows what the kind of free-form kind of presenter I am? I was at a Lincoln game at the weekend and there was a kind of bad challenge 50-50 tackle. And our players, I'm so convinced, we are just far too nice. We're nice people, and it really winds me up. Because we didn't, like, fly into the referee going crazy. We did a little bit, but not quite as much as other teams have done against us. And obviously, in this instance, there was a bit of that. People fly in. When you were a player, was that discussed, or is it just, like, unspoken that you, like, if we charge in here and, like, start pushing people and make out like it's an assault, that might rev things up to be a red card? Because it does make a difference, doesn't it? There's the classic thing that commentators always say, oh, he's done him a favour there. But if you get fouled and then you stand straight back up then you've probably helped your opponent out by making it not look bad.
I would say that there's two things. There's one or two managers I played for would say, get onto the ref. So that would be a fundamental thing, a belief that they think you can influence the referee if you're always in his ear. And I think there's probably some truth in that. Otherwise, why would everyone do it? Jurgen Klopp's probably the biggest example. The other thing is then it just comes down to the personality of the players in the team. I think if there's someone, if you have like a group of players in your team who are kind of prone to doing that, basically, maybe your team just doesn't have those characters in it. That doesn't make them weak or like nice or anything, but it's just...
Lovely lads, I'd have them round for tea, no problem.
Yeah, but you know, some people thought there was a value in it and had the energy to do it as well. Mm. I prefer to kind of just have focus on the game. If there was something really, really riled you, but I fundamentally always kind of try to focus on the game.
Yeah, because I mean, there is a difference, obviously, and I'd probably say there probably were challenges that you saw that you did want to be like, have a defending feeling for your teammate because you were like, that is a shocker. How have you done that to my teammate?
Yeah.
But I think this one is one where really a lot of players make that kind of a tackle, you know, the orange card. And so it is that revving up.
I don't know, he's running at speed. I think I'm not surprised some of his teammates were pretty angry about it. And Emerson was rolling around in some discomfort. So I don't have any sympathy for him with this. I agree. Like, if he hadn't been sent off, I wouldn't have a problem with it. Yeah. But I don't have a problem with him being sent off for that either.
That's a slight tangent, but connected.
Love tangents.
I do feel if a player rolls more than once, that should be a yellow card.
Gregor ever rolled more than once after being tackled? You can't do that in the Football League, can you?
No, probably not.
It's one of the things, like, I have played football properly in leagues and cup games and stuff. I have played competitive football with men and with women. So I have a tiny understanding of how it feels to be on the pitch when it matters. But the one thing I think I cannot get my head around is what makes somebody, if you're hurt, if you've been kicked, your Achilles has been hurt or you've had a kick on the knee, how in any way the normal human response is to roll and then roll and then roll and then roll.
It's not the normal human response.
Exactly. So you should be booked for it. Yeah. You should book for it. Because if you are hurt, you're going to exacerbate your injury.
There's too many things that we're booking people for.
But B, you are, you're clearly by rolling, your only motivation must be to alert the referee to the fact that you've been fouled. And it's really serious, referee. It's really serious. I think you should be sent off. I'm going to roll again. It's so obvious that we have to stop it.
It's a very, very strange thing. I mean, it brings to mind, and we're talking of tangents, I'm heading off into tennis here, because the thing, just very quickly, you know the thing when they always win at Wimbledon and they fall on the floor, on their back?
Yes.
Like, that's got to be the least obvious reaction to that moment ever, isn't it? You're going tops off, you're running around, you're jumping up, you're going absolutely crazy. And they all do that daft, like, they've just passed out and they fall on their back because they saw someone do it. And
to be fair, if you're playing tennis for 4 hours or whatever, it may just be pure exhaustion.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe I'm being harsh. Anyway, back to the football. The mystery penalty. Where's the foul? Who saw it? What on earth is going on? Greg has got his games gone, head shape, face on. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy.
Well, in my initial thought was, you're talking about Areola, aren't you? My first thought was, at last, a referee who isn't just going to protect the goalkeeper, come what may. Because goalkeepers foul too. So, yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised that a referee had the bottle to say, no, I can see, although he might have been trying to come for the ball, what he's done is taken the player out. Although a little forensic examination of the footage makes you think, I don't know that he definitely saw what he thought he saw. And maybe that should have been properly analysed. Because none of us really like VAR, but if you're going to say VAR has a role, it's for things like that are a bit, where there are angles and limbs and who's looking at the ball, who isn't looking at the ball, who shoved someone into the path of the goalkeeper. It was a bit of a mess and it needs somebody to look at images and work out what the initial foul was.
I think the conclusion is there wasn't one. I think Peter Walton said that, he summed it up in his little piece in the paper today. Like, some people are, you know, saying that there was actually a foul on Areola because he had a burst lip, and McBurney was kind of back, but McBurney was pushed as well. It was like, it was just a coming together that happens. Yeah. He was slightly reckless in the fact that he went for that ball in that period in the game. And didn't get it. You know, it's like, but he didn't, it was not a foul. There was no foul there.
No.
And I don't know how someone can watch that back and not come to that conclusion. But this is where we are.
Crazy. Strange one. And then at the other end, Jared Bowen, rugby tackled to the ground. Defenders Union, here we go.
I don't know, I have a little bit of sympathy for, like,
For
Anel, I won't try and say his name, Ahmed Hodzic.
Yeah.
He had a little spiky kind of tweet afterwards where he was showing some sort of, there was some analysis, I think, in the TV studio of it, and pundits were saying this is a, you know, I don't know how it's a stonewall penalty. And he, you know, although I didn't like the start of the tweet, he was saying, clearly biased. But then he went to explain, there's another angle where you see that Jared Bowen is pulling me towards the floor and I am looking at the ball. And to be fair, they did show that in Match of the Day as well. You know, once, by the time the camera and the kind of live action comes round, all you see is Ahmed Hodzic with his arms round Bowen, not even looking at the ball, and falling to the ground. But before that, Bowen had his arm round both shoulders, was pulling him to the ground, and Ahmed Hodzic was looking at the ball. So it looked bad, I get it, but I do think that was a bit of kind of six and a half a dozen.
Do you get taught that as a defender? Because surely that's the art of good defending, isn't it? To be able to be in that scenario where, as you say, six of one and get the decision your way. Because it happens all the time. You know, as I said, I go back to the game I was at in League One on Saturday, Lincoln's young striker, we were loving him because he was getting really tight to the centre-back, but basically fouling him. He was pulling his shirt all the time, but he kept getting the free kicks. I mean, and that is, there's an art to that, isn't there?
There is,
make the referee think that you're being fouled when actually it is six of one.
There is, but I mean, again, I wouldn't have been too surprised if the referee had pointed to the spot, if they'd just caught the aftermath, you know, the kind of tail end of that incident. I don't think his position was good either, because you should still never be in the position where your body shape is actually facing away from the ball where the ball is being crossed in. But he was being pulled by Jared Bowen initially, and then he fell to the ground. So I think it was the right decision.
Alison, penalty? No penalty?
No, I agree completely. I actually felt it wasn't a penalty upon first viewing. So
okay,
there we go. Honestly, I thought we'd fall out way more than that. I thought it was a penalty. There you go. But I just stick that in there. I would just say as well, the thinking about VAR, when you go to a game that doesn't have it, as I say, there was this controversial tackle, and also we had a penalty appeal, which was this young striker again. Referee gave him a yellow card for diving. Crowd's going crazy, and at no point did I think, God, I wish we had VAR.
And when a goal goes in,
yeah,
I was at Southampton game last weekend, and it was There's no like momentary kind of pause or hesitation to see whether it's going to be an actual goal or not. It's brilliant.
Yeah, well, we'll save this for when we're in the old people's home going, oh, it was better in our day. Because I'm sure it will get down to the Football League eventually. Sheffield United, I don't want to dwell. We talk about West Ham and David Moyes a lot. They're still sixth. The season's going okay. But Sheffield United, Chris Wilder, 10th point of the season from 21 games. As much as we might be looking at Nottingham Forest and Everton and their situations off the pitch and potential further points deductions, these are the games they kind of need to start winning, don't they, really?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the kind of the bigger picture, he has had an effect, and they've been, you know, even in games they've lost, you know, the Villa game as well, for instance, they could have easily won, they nearly did a job on Villa. Liverpool, you know, they didn't score the second goal until, like, late on in the game. So they have been right in games, and he has had an effect. I was also really excited to see Ben Brereton and Diaz, and he looked like he had an impact as well. He's an all-action player. He kind of... I remember I did a piece about Forest Academy years ago when they beat Arsenal. Do you remember they beat Arsenal in the Cup?
Yeah.
A long time ago. And a friend of mine, Jack Lester, who's now on the coaching staff there, picked out two players that were going to kind of... from the Academy. And it was Brereton Diaz and Ryan Yates. And both now are kind of... forces of nature in the Premier League. That's what they are, and he is that. I think he will be impactful, and Willa Sula as well. I have to say, he's a kind of academy player who Liverpool, among other teams, are looking at, and he's very highly rated. Obviously, he's young and he's, you know, he's raw, and it's hard to rely on him in this situation. But I think we might see more of him as he sort of gets to grips with playing in the Premier League. And McAtee's been outstanding as well. So I think actually, going forward, Sheffield United will be okay. I just don't think they're going to keep out enough goals. Like, I think they need to strengthen in defence before the end of this month if they've got going to have any chance. And I know everyone's writing them off. I still have a flickering feeling that they might have a chance.
Well, what's impressive about them is that they're not supposed to have a chance. Mm. You know, no one's escaped from this position before. And yet they don't play... like that. They haven't got a fatalism about them.
No.
If you had no idea what the table said and you just tuned in to watch that game, you would have thought they're safe. That this is a mid-table team enjoying life in the Premier League. You know, the fans weren't jittery. The players, they lack quality when it mattered, but you could not fault their fearlessness and endeavour and energy, and there was a quite strong sense of camaraderie given all the changes. I mean, West Ham were off the boil a bit, but they were in a position to take advantage of that. That they didn't enough. Well, you know, that's what happens when you're a team with such small resources. But you know, there wasn't that sense of it's over. And then that's quite a miracle, I think, from a managerial point of view. If you can instill that into your players when you are the position you're in the league, that's impressive.
Do you think, looking at, obviously, and we talked on Thursday, Gregor, about the potential for this future points deductions to not come in until late in the season, but if you are the bottom three, and Alison, you talk about the table, Sheffield United bottom with 10 points, Burnley 19th with 12, Luton 18th with 16, then Everton 17 points in 17th, and Forest 16th with 20 points. If you're looking at it and there's those three teams below and looking above, are there two from three that you think could capitalise on a potential points deduction? Which are the two?
It's funny. I would have more faith in Sheffield United collecting more points than Burnley actually between now and the end of the season. And Luton are going to be right in it until the end, I think.
Mm.
Look, if more than one of them are to stay up, then undoubtedly they're going to need a favour by the Premier League, and it still might not be enough.
Do we think the two teams above them? Because I think Forest are looking like a team that could probably take a points deduction and still survive. I don't know whether Everton could take 2 points deductions. I love Sean Dyche, but I don't know if he's that good.
No. Yeah, no, I agree. I think Forest could take a points deduction and probably just about survive. If Everton get another one, then it'd be a miracle.
Alison, any of those bottom three giving you hope that with the help of a Premier League and a points deduction, they could survive?
Won't
be Burnley. You hate Vincent Kompany, don't you?
I don't hate Vincent Kompany. But I do. I think he lacks... the necessary pragmatism, but that sense of fatalism I see on occasion with Burnley. They are occasionally attractive to watch and so on. But there are passages of games at Burnley where you feel that they don't believe, the players don't believe. So whereas I feel like Sheffield United, although they shouldn't, do look like
The reality with Sheffield United is still actually the team that they have now aren't going to stay up. Mm. But I think, and also kind of knowing Chris Wilder, he will do everything in his power to get to strengthen. And like, I think they could do a goalkeeper too. Mm. He's been linked with Schmeichel. I think they need to strengthen at the back if they're going to have any chance. Because it's just that kind of, it is the cutting edge in both boxes that's doing for them. Mm. That's often the case with teams who are relegated, but Sheffield United do have the kind of the spirit and the sort of energy still to suggest that they might be able to do something.
Well, if you've got views on how that relegation battle might pan out, or maybe you just want to tell me how stupid I am for thinking Leanne Brewster shouldn't have been sent off, then get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us, we're going to be talking about Arsenal and Ivan Toney next.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and today I'm joined by Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. We move to the Emirates. Arsenal back in the goals after two games without any at the Emirates. Set pieces seem to be doing the trick for Mikel Arteta. In the piece that we've got in The Times today, we've got some lovely graphics talking about how Arsenal have scored more set piece goals from anyone this season, and only three teams have conceded fewer. Arsenal out in front on 13, Everton next with 11, then Man City at Tottenham and Luton all on 9. Gregor, is this clever coaching, looking at a way that you can kind of, at all areas of the pitch, the best teams do it, don't they? Last season, Arsenal were free-flowing, attacking, exciting football, coming from both flanks, overlapping fullbacks. Now they're making sure they're doing it the Sean Dyche way.
That's very clever, yeah. I mean, James Gearbrand outlined it in his piece today that, you know, they're basically their attack and play from open play as kind of a mid-table team. In terms of the quality of chances that they're creating, and set pieces are a major reason why that's not had a debilitating effect on their season. So, Nicholas Jover has been his impact has been pretty profound, really. Since it was the same as in his first season at the club as well, they've been consistently at the top of that list. And the first one in particular was really, really interesting to watch, the way that Trossard kind of made an arcing run to back into Anderson, wasn't it, I think? Mm. Just to kind of, just to hold him in that spot a little bit to allow Gabriel to attack it. I find these fascinating, I really do, because it's not really something that you know, we worked in set pieces when I was a player, but never to this degree and to this level of detail.
Almost like a dance routine, isn't it?
It's quite a kind of modern thing, yeah. I mean, you know, the association with Brentford and Michelin as well, I think, they were the kind of first to do it. And now a lot of teams have set piece coaches, and it's recognised as a very valuable, you know, a hugely important part of
part of the team's preparations. I think Arsenal are the club that make it the most obvious. Everyone knows who Jova is, and that when there's a set piece with either defending or attacking, Arteta disappears from the technical area and Jova takes over, which, I mean, James Gearbrand does make an NFL analogy, but that makes it a really obvious one, actually, to me, is that you almost have a different coach in charge just for those moments of the game. It's like those clocks where people go ping ping and you see the lady, and then ping ping and then you see the gentleman, and it's like that.
Yeah, Villa do that as well with Austin McPhee. I think often Emery's kind of takes a backward step and he steps out to the front of the. You know, it's someone taking responsibility for all the work they've done. And as I say, this, you know, a lot of these. I remember doing a piece about this actually about 18 months ago, and I spoke to the person who was the best at this in my time was Alan Nil, who's now Chris Wilder's assistant, and he had a real interest in the NFL, and he also just watched obscure leagues around the world and stuff and picked up ideas. And a big thing that is often about is getting first contact. This is what's slightly different. A lot of them are about blocking now with Arsenal and Jova. A lot of the time with these routines, it's about making sure you get the first contact. So it's kind of manipulating a way of getting someone to the front post.
The opposite because of you can't beat the first man, which is what every fan says.
Because if you win the first contact, it creates chaos.
Yeah.
That's the kind of the theory. Whereas, you know, if you see a corner come in, you can watch it all the way. If you get the first contact on it, then no one really knows what the next thing is. And as long as if you've got people attacking an area, then that's the kind of theory behind it. But what Jover seems to do very well, and there's been other examples as well, is tries to get, is forms kind of really clever ways of getting blocks. And
are they fouls?
Well, this is the thing. There's been a bit of this weekend about, you know, we'll come to Tony afterwards. It's about how you bend the rules to the without breaking them.
Well, and the Bowen thing, that's why I was saying to you, the 6-1 thing. And that is, you talk about these corners and you see it whether you're watching the Premier League or League One or anything. There's technically probably fouls happening in the box all over the place.
Yeah.
People literally hold on to it.
And the second one where Henderson's kind of pinned.
Or there's the player standing in front of the goalkeeper.
Exactly.
Whose job it is
exactly.
to do that. And then the other player comes and stands behind him and shoves him in the back. There's probably about three counter fouls going back and forth there.
But if you do it subtly enough,
yeah.
then you get away with it. And look, that's part of the game. It's always been part of the game.
Yeah. But so you would rather that just carries on?
Absolutely. Just, I mean... Yeah. There are already too many things that are judged to be fouls. So
even when you were playing then, if you got pinned, you wouldn't have been going, ref, you'd have been going, oh, I got done.
Of course I would, but I would have thought that at the same time.
You'd have known actually, in reality, bollocks,
absolutely.
I got done there.
I mean, there was very simple ways of doing that when I played. If someone was making a forward run, another defender would run kind of the opposite direction and kind of almost like fake and pretend to bump into you accidentally.
Oh my God, I didn't see you.
Yeah. But now these are really kind of, you know, intricate ideas.
Yeah.
The way that Trossard spun and made a really like a run that no one could have followed or done anything about, in fact. I think it's fascinating.
But are we saying, come on, are we saying they work so hard on the choreography of set pieces that they're too tired to play well in open play? I mean, I don't see why one has to be...
But the
narrative, Tom, is Arsenal from open play are a mid-table team, but it doesn't matter because they're dominating the set piece charts. Why is it an either or?
I just love a good
surely a team that's going to win the title.
I don't think
they have to do both bits properly.
Absolutely,
of course,
absolutely.
I don't think they think it's an either or either. But what it does is when you're playing against a team who, you know, are for large spells of the game going to be in a low block, it gets you an early goal or two, and then they have to come out. And you saw that they exploited the space afterwards.
Well, I'm under pressure to provide some opinions, so instead I'm just going to nick James Gearbrand's with a payoff to his piece, Alison. Of course, Arsenal's proficiency in the supplementary aspect does not absolve them of the need to sharpen up their creation and finishing in conventional open play scenarios. They will need to get better at facing low blocks. And I agree with him. I think if they're going to progress, which was going to be my next question, that they're still in the title race, points-wise. But even against teams like Palace, who have these low blocks, they still don't look yet like they've found a solution to that. And going forward, presumably then the counterpunch from opposition, Gregor, would be that you think about Arsenal, well, they're just going to play for set pieces. So don't give them set pieces, get better at marking. Is that not how it works constantly? Because that's where Arsenal have been stopped this season, isn't it? With the low blocks and working out that, you know, it comes from Saka and Martinelli out on the flanks. If you can stop them, I think you said a few weeks ago that, you know, it's a bit basic, and it's obviously more nuanced than that. But essentially, if you can kind of stop them and stop that threat out wide and the overlaps, you're in a good position.
That's been one, you know, a kind of feature of Arsenal's play this season, absolutely. And the fact that if Odegaard isn't allowed any space sort of on front of the opposition's back four as well, there's not really much creativity.
Hmm.
You saw Zinchenko step in and play an absolutely outstanding ball, kind of defence split and pass. It was early in the first half, but there's really, I don't know, they are lacking something, a bit of craft, I think, in the middle of the pitch.
Are they lacking something that we talked about maybe with Liverpool, that just a slight bit of hectic madness that you've just said about getting the first contact on a set piece because it then creates madness for the opposition? Are they lacking a bit of that this season, in that they're a bit more, you know, at the start of the season we were praising them 2-0 to the Arsenal, 1-0 to the Arsenal, and they'd maybe lost a bit of that free-flowing madness that they had last season, which was why we loved them so much. And God, they're wonderful. They're a breath of fresh air. We all hope they win the title instead of City, everyone's favourite team. Have they lost a bit of that this season?
Well, it's the overcorrection problem, isn't it? That you perceive the reason you didn't win the title or finish where you wanted to finish because of flaws in what you had that season. And so if the flaw is perceived to be a bit too emotional, it's not grown up enough, not mentally ready to accept the challenge of being winners, then you overcorrect and you become highly coached and lacking that sort of flair and ability to think on the hoof. And so they have become they do look more grown up, Arsenal, but they also look predictable and lacking verve, and that's quite easy to play against often, isn't it?
Are we writing them off then? I know you were joking before about me giving opinions on the title race. I don't think they're out of the title race. I think, you know, I think it might be a stretch for Villa, but I think it is still a three-team title race at the very least. Are we saying that Arsenal third is probably where they're going to be?
I think so. Because of the overcorrection.
Mm.
Maybe it needs yet another season where they realise they should blend this season and the season before.
I would be wary to write them off just yet. I think, I could see them beating Liverpool.
Hmm.
You know, that wouldn't be a major surprise. I could see them beating the best teams. You know, and it's whether they can do it against the low blocks is probably the bigger challenge, bigger sort of question mark just now. Then the fact that they've not hit anything like the stride yet, and they're still in the conversation. So
that's the point
that
for me.
In itself is a kind of is something that I would take as a positive if I was an Arsenal fan.
Is that I wonder if they've got a kick, you know, a final kick coming in the you know, you said about Odegaard hasn't been at his best this season. You'd assume a player of his ability will step up at some point. You can't think they'll go the whole season without working out how to beat the low blocks. You know, it's still only January. I just think they might come again. They might have a little run. Whereas last season, they ran and ran and ran and then ran out of steam. We're still waiting for them to really, really excel this season.
And the other important point to stress is that they have the best defence in the league. It's always going to give them a chance, particularly if you can pop up with the odd set piece too.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, talking about players that are going to be important and hoping to come on to a run for the end of the season, Ivan Toney is definitely going to be one of them. Gregor, you've written the piece that Alison mentioned earlier at the start of the show, which is headlined on the Times website. Ivan Toney still has that rare confidence I first saw when he was 18. I witnessed the striker's unstinting self-belief when he was my Northampton teammate in 2014, and that is the main reason why I think he'll play for a top club. So before we get into Toney's return, tell us a bit more about that piece and some of the things Alison was talking about earlier.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I wrote a preview about this game about Ivan Toney. I went to the game, wrote a kind of scouting report for the Sunday Times, and then it comes to like, what are you going to write about the Monday?
Who are these stupid editors who get all these bloody requests all the time?
But they need some more imagination. But the game, I've never, ever, ever seen a game, or in fact, there's not a game I can ever remember that was so dominated by one individual. It was, you know, you went to the game and there was a huge billboard outside the GTEC saying, "He's back, he's back, he's back, he's back." There was this crazy, like, welcome back video before. Did you see it?
Yeah.
Where the lights dropped, it kind of glowed red. There was the Undertaker WWE style kind of church tolls. Like, and then Jay-Z's song came in and he was like, allow me to reintroduce myself with like a montage.
Sad you didn't wrap that, but anyway.
And you're thinking, crikey, like...
You sound disapproving, Gregor.
No, at that point, I was like, "No, this
he's forgotten his roots, young Ivan." That, I remember him when he's at Northampton.
I was thinking at that point, this is too much because look, he'd done a clutch of interviews before it. He was absolutely, you know, willing to stand up and say, "I'm going to hit the ground running. I've been waiting for this. I can't wait to get back." Which in itself is like it kind of. It grabs you a little bit. You think, wow, this guy's got some confidence. And as I say in this piece, you know, it didn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me because I saw him when he was 17, 18, when I played him for like a year. And he was like jarringly confident for that age. Mm.
There's what a great story in there about a failed transfer move.
Yeah,
that
he never
says a lot about
he never he said his goodbyes in November 2014. Because Wolves had a £500,000 bid accepted. He went up. He's since admitted that he took pictures with the strip. He did everything. He signed the contract, did everything basically. And then the medical came back. They found he had scoliosis, which is like a curvature of the spine. And it fell through. So he came back into training the next day. And I remember we're sitting in the gym and I was like, "What happened, Ive?" And he said, they only offered me $3,000 a week. And I was like, and it didn't surprise me.
So you didn't know about the medical?
We didn't know, yeah. He was telling everyone a little white lie, but he chose to tell a lie about them not offering him enough money. You know, that tells you kind of a little bit about how he feels about himself. Yeah, like he was willing to say, they're not valuing me enough. But the reality is, he'd failed the medical. He wanted to keep that to himself, but which was perfectly understandable. And he just forgot about that as well. You know, when you're 18 and you fail a medical and somebody's told you you've got a dodgy back, you know, that might elicit a few doubts in some people. He earned a move to Newcastle 9 months later.
Mm.
So there was that. There was also just the fact that, as I've said in the piece as well, we were like in a relegation battle in League Two and we're two games to go before the end of the season. And he was saying all the time, I should be playing. And Chris Wilder finally gave him a start and he scored 4 goals in the last 2 games. Kept us up almost single-handedly. And it's like, right, okay, this guy's, you know, he backs it up as well. So I did know about that. But now, and again, as we've said before, I interviewed him again just after he got the move to Brentford. So he'd been playing League One the season before. He'd never even played a Premier League game. And he was telling me, "I think I'm going to play for England. Like, I'm going to play the Champions League. I want to win titles. All this good stuff." And you're like, okay. And he backed it up and he stepped up. So, again, all the stuff that's been swirling in the last week or so, and, you know, it must have been quite hard. You can talk about the rights and wrongs of what he did, and a lot of people have, but to be under that much scrutiny, to have had, in fact, even before that, to have had over a year of being under investigation by the FA and being the third best striker in the Premier League at that time, all the while, it's pretty remarkable.
Mm.
And so this piece I wrote today was kind of just underlining that I think he has an elite mindset.
Mm.
Like, and I know that sounds like a bit jargony, and it's, you know, I referenced, he always talks about visualisation too. He always talks about imagining. He said on the pitch afterwards, I manifested this. I visualised it before I left my house, and I made it happen. That's what he said to the Sky Sports camera after the game. It's like an immense sort of self-belief.
Yeah, but that's what the very top athletes do. I've mentioned tennis, so I'm going to bring cricket in now. There's sort of opinions from all over the place. But I always remember watching an interview with former Australia batsman and captain Ricky Ponting, who said in his hotel room the night before, he'd stay up for hours, like not just shadow batting, but like visualising scoring runs and where he would do it, and he'd think about the crowd and what the weather would be like.
Yeah.
So that when you then went out there, you'd go, "I've done this already."
And I referenced a few people at the start of the piece too. Mohamed Salah meditates before every game. And he said that he often scores goals in his mind that become reality on the pitch. So like the goals he scores, you know, the little ones where he's weaving in from the right and slotting it in the far corner, he dreamt that the night before the game, yeah. And then he makes it reality. Wayne Rooney used to always say, used to ask the kit man, what colour strip are we playing in? So that when he was visualising the night before him scoring goals, he would do it in the right colour strip. And Kylian Mbappe was saying that he always thinks to himself when he steps on any pitch, I am the best player on this pitch, even though sometimes he's been facing a pitch, you know, an opponent who had Messi or Ronaldo in the team.
And but they do that because sports psychologists tell them to. This is an accepted thing to do, to visualise.
Yeah, but doing it and, you know, even trying to practice it and actually doing it is a very different thing. And that's why I referenced that story and that you referenced at the start of the podcast, Alison, because I was playing in a. I referenced this story because it's still seared in my memory about the kind of power of the mind.
Yeah.
Is that it was my first full season in the academy at Nottingham Forest, and we won our kind of league. Liverpool won their league in the Premier League academy system, and we met in the semi final of a playoff, and so it was a big game for me and my world at that time, and the ball fell. I was facing my own goal. And I said, not short. And I played a short back pass. And Neil Mellor, who you know went on to do quite well, nipped in, round the keeper, scored. And I just remember after that thinking, that was because I said to myself, don't do this, rather than do this in a positive way. Mm. I said it in a sort of negative, fear of failure way. Mm. And so I find it fascinating because I know it's actually very hard to you can easily you know have positive affirmations, you can visualize what you want to do, but actually turning it into reality is the thing that is what makes you a real success or not. And Ivan Toney's doing it. Mm. He's doing it. He said all the things he was going to do and he's doing them. And so I think there's more to come. And largely, look, he's a good player. I'm not saying he's going to reach the heights of the players I've referenced there. He lacks a yard of pace compared, you know, if he had a yard of pace, I'd say he could go all the way. Like, but he's going to score goals. He's proven in the Premier League. I think we now recognise after that 100-minute appearance, you know, he didn't even have to come off in this game. He's fit and ready. And it's a matter of when he gets a move.
Is it also a matter of who he is his manager, though? Because let's have a little for Thomas Frank, who's handled him right from the start brilliantly. So he's got the very best out of him the minute he took him on at Brentford. Thomas Frank made him his player of the season last season and made a point of saying, not because he handled the betting allegations over him, because he was playing while we were all wondering what was going to happen to him, which would, you know, make people think, is that a distraction? He said it wasn't for that, although that was obviously part of it. It was just that he made it clear that regardless of all this external stuff, he remains an important part of the team who gives so much energy to my players. So he's always bigging him up for things other than linked to how he's coping with the betting scandal.
Yeah.
And Brentford and Frank have handled his comeback perfectly because they're very pragmatic about the fact they're going to make a huge amount of money on him. They know that.
Well, actually,
things have changed. They were fully expecting to let him go for big money in January, but they've had a raft of injuries that have made them fall down the table. So they've now created an environment where I think that Tony feels comfortable staying with them to make sure that they have a decent end to the season with that, and that he can show off still and still get a big move in the summer. That's quite a complicated thing to navigate, shift in perception.
Absolutely agree. I think I said it in the piece, I think they played an absolute blinder because everything they've done is made sure that Tony comes back in the best frame of mind. It means that also the way that they kind of talk down what he did and talk up what he is helps retain the value of their biggest asset as well. You know, if he comes back and he came back and hit the ground running, immediately everyone goes, okay, any doubts, any question marks about whether Ivan Toney is going to take a while to get back up to pace? Somebody could now come in and say, there's 80 million, what are you going to do?
Mm.
And it wouldn't feel like stupid or a risk. Whereas until you saw him back in action and you saw what kind of frame of mind he was in and you saw, you know, whether he was rust, you know, ring rusty or whatever, I was completely dispelled. Yeah. Like,
it's interesting thinking about Thomas Frank as well. Molly went to the press conference at the weekend, and I was speaking to her about it before. And some of the things you talked about, Gregor, with going and there was a video and everyone's talking about it. Frank said he's like Eric Cantona before the match. And Eric Cantona, of course, had a big long spell out for Manchester United and then came back. And I remember being a young lad growing up, and there was loads of footage around it and things. And it was the same thing. There were scarves outside. All the United fans had dressed up as Cantona and everything like that. And you think, Molly's ringing me up and going, he's Cantona. Bloody hell, he's not Cantona. But actually, it's all part of it, isn't it? It's all part of that sense of, he might not be Cantona, but he's our Cantona.
Yeah. And it's also, there's not many parallels to this, you know, like, and he was also comparing him, I think, to that kind of, to someone who had a supreme confidence too. Mm. So there were kind of little parallels with that. With, of course, he's not Cantona, but he is a hugely important. He also lifted all the boats around him.
Yeah.
Like Neil Mopai.
So did they look better?
Oh, Neil Mopai looked like a different player. It was clunky at first. You think, you know, because Tony thrived with his partnership with Mbeumo, who's obviously out for a long time with an ankle injury, and it looked a bit clunky at start. He was kind of, you know, one would drop off. They tried. He had a chance to slip in. Tony played it too far wide. Tony dropped off and tried a little ball around the corner, which nearly came off. Didn't. But then they found their kind of flow together. They worked really well, and Tony often drifted wide and linked up with Roerslev, the right wing back, and Mopai was the guy who was down the middle. So they played like two intelligent strikers, and I'd say there's some promise in that partnership between now and the end of the season.
You're right with the I think you hinted at it before, but is, you know, gamesmanship, should we call it, or is it cheating?
I couldn't care less.
Couldn't care less. Fine. Let's. Alison, just final word.
Yes, final word from me. I don't know what you were going to ask, but also, I mean, Brentford are, you know, they're still relatively new to the Premier League. They are a relatively small club with a small budget, and yet they've had two of the biggest individual player stories in recent years, with Christian Eriksen coming back and now the Ivan Toney coming back, completely different, but they've handled both absolutely superbly and got the best out of both individuals in what could have been incredibly difficult circumstances and just gone wrong. I mean, you think, what people do talk about how well-run they are in an economic sense, but in terms of culture,
emotional
and
intelligence,
what to do,
all that kind
absolutely.
Of stuff. I mean, I said in my piece, how many managers, other Premier League managers, do you think would have sanctioned a massive billboard and that gaudy video, like, before kickoff, making it so much about? I think most managers would be trying to play it down, be like, yeah, it might take a bit of time to get up to speed. No, they were the opposite, because they know Ivan Toney's personality and they embraced it. Mm. They were saying, he's ready. He's like a kid in a sweet shop. He can't wait. So let's let him free.
And also, can we just remind people who might not have watched the game or have watched much of Brentford with Toney in it? He's not selfish. He plays an awful lot of unselfish, clever balls for his teammates. So he might get the pre-assist or the assist. He's very good at not just thinking about, oh, visualise this, I'm going to score. He's thinking about how to make the team better. He's a great team player.
Yeah,
he certainly is. And you can read more about Ivan Toney, because believe me, there is more about Ivan Toney, as much as we've talked about him for a long time on this podcast, on the Times website. Now, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday to discuss who's made it to the final of the EFL Cup.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.